Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge Knives. Now, Outdoor Edge has a large range of fixed and replaceable blade knives and game cleaning kits. Now, imagine this. You just shot a deer in the backcountry, or an elk, or whatever, and it's time to break it down, right? It's hot. You're a long way from the truck, so time is a factor, and you got to get the meat back to the truck so there's no waste. Your blade becomes dull, so instead of having to stop and sharpen the blade, all you do is you take your Outdoor Edge knife, you push a button on the handle, the blade pops out, you put a new blade back in, and you're back to work. You get back to the truck, there's no wasted meat, everybody wins. Now, if you want to find out more information about Outdoor Edge and their complete line of knives and game cleaning kits, all you have to do is go to outdooredge.com, and when you check out or you decide you want to purchase a knife, enter the discount code NATION30 and you're going to save 30% off of your purchase. That's NATION30 and that's outdooredge.com. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, whenever you're listening to this. Hopefully everybody is having a great day, month, year, whatever. It's the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. It's brought to you by Vortex Optics, and we have another really interesting episode for you today. Today, I'm joined by Nicole Qualtieri. Now, Nicole is an editor for GearJunkie.com, and we met at the ATA show this past year, and she's been on a couple panels, and we have both been in some of these meetings that's been put on by the ATA to find ways that the media and influencers, I hate that term, but influencers can help properly promote hunting, to shed light to people who might not be hunters, to say, hey man, you should really check out hunting. And so that's the connection between me and today's guest. But it's a really awesome episode, right? And I think what I really liked about this conversation is her journey into hunting. It wasn't a traditional journey, you know, like, hey, she had a friend who took her hunting. She got a job within the hunting industry. Then she, through her connections and whatnot, she found out that this passion, this love that hunters have for animals, you know, and her story is really unique. And that's why I wanted to share it with you guys today. So what are we going to do? We're going to share her story. I'm going to talk to you about, I got to do a commercial real quick. So today we're going to talk about The Average Conservationist. The Average Conservationist is an apparel company. They make some badass t-shirts. They make some badass hoodies, some badass hats. My favorite hat are the trucker style hats with the patches on them. There's one that I really like, but right now my son has kind of taken a liking to it, so he wears it all over the place. It is a camel hat with a patch on it that has a broadhead. It's The Average Conservationist. Now, it's more than just badass apparel with cool logos on it. It is a company that when they started, they made the decision to give 10% of their profits back to conservation. So just by wearing one of their t-shirts or wearing one of their hats, you are responsible for giving back to conservation just by purchasing their products, you know, in an indirect way. So if you want to find out more information about what these guys do for their giving back to conservation, what organizations, and find out more about the products that these guys have out, go ahead and check out theaverageconservationist.com. And you know, I'm telling you, it's some pretty kick-ass gear. So other than that, let's get into today's, man, I don't even know what to call this. I think I'm going to call it kind of a hunter profile podcast, but we're going to be talking with Nicole Qualtieri, and that episode starts right now. In 3, 2, 1. All right. On the phone with me today, Miss Nicole Qualtieri. Nicole, how are we doing?
I'm doing really good. How are you, Dan?
Can't complain, man. I believe the first time I ever met you was at a piano bar at the ATA show. I think that was...
Oh, no.
Yeah. I can't remember if that was the after we had the ATA media meeting or before, but that was the first time I ever met you. So I don't know if you knew that or not.
Well, I was really enjoying myself that night. So
I think we all were.
I would say that, like, I definitely, I'm sorry that that's the place that you had to meet me for the first time.
No, don't worry about that.
That's what about with the lacrosse team. They feed you a lot of champagne. And if you're me, you get really sassy at the piano bar with everyone. So that's generally like what happened.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun night.
Yeah.
A hard next day, though.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you what, I try to, at least, especially at the ATA show, I've kind of learned my lesson over the years to where, and even in the smaller trade shows that I go to, where you just got to talk yourself into going to bed early, because it's not worth it the next day. But then sometimes you get pulled into an event like that, and you go with the flow.
Well, so, like, one of my best girlfriends and I got dinner together. She works for lacrosse. And so I think that's where like trade shows can get like a little bit out of control, because you're with people that you really love and like,
yeah,
you only get to see them every once in a while. And I'm like you, I tend, like at SHOT Show, I think I was in bed every night by like 9:30 or 10. So like, but you know, after, I will say that like this past January, so I went to a SHOT Show, I went to, I can't even remember what other trade show I went to, and ATA. And it was like 3 weeks of just constant trade show. And I think at ATA, I was just done, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
at some point you just sort of, you know, it becomes too much, and it's very easy to just get into that sense.
Yeah. I haven't made the trip to the SHOT Show yet, and I just don't feel like me and Las Vegas would ever get along under any rules and regulations. I don't even know if I ever want to visit that town.
It's really good until you get together with like all of the outdoor writers that you like really know and love, and somehow you stay up until 5 o'clock in the morning because you haven't seen the sun in 4 days.
Yeah.
And then miss your 6 o'clock flight, which is what I did.
Whew.
2 years ago.
Yikes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of good stories that come out of trade shows.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel that's the truth. Well, we're gonna pull a hard pivot here, and we're gonna talk a little bit about your introduction into hunting, because I think it's a unique, not only being a female, but being new, quote unquote new, or having a cool story of not necessarily coming from a hunting family or being a hunter and now becoming a hunter. I think you have a really cool story. And before we get into that, why don't we talk a little bit about where do you live and what do you do for a living?
Yeah, sure. So I live in Butte, Montana, which my family is actually from Butte, but I didn't grow up here. I'm from Ohio and Colorado, really. But people in Butte call it Butte America. It's kind of its own little country in the middle of Montana. And pretty small town. Lots of really great hunting and fishing nearby, though. And I am the hunting and fishing editor for GearJunkie.com. And people on the outdoor rec side are probably a little bit more familiar with Gear Junkie. You know, we discuss everything from skiing to road running to travel to hiking and backpacking, like really an all-inclusive outdoor rec site. And for us, that also means including hunting and fishing. So it's a really great place to work. I love my coworkers. My team is great. I'm one of four hunters and anglers on our team, so there aren't very many of us, but it's great because we have like a great diversity of perspective. And I get to talk a lot from the perspective of being a newer hunter, like helping people get into hunting and making sure that like what we put out is, if someone who is a trail runner sees a hunting article that they want to read, that it's going to be a welcoming place for them and not one that feels insular or confusing. So
yeah.
I really love that aspect of my job.
Yeah. And the connection that we're making here is that, you know, at the ATA show this year, and even I think it was last week or the week before, the ATA held kind of a little meeting or a little gathering of media. I don't want to say influencers because I absolutely hate that word influencer, but people within the media that are in the hunting industry in some way, shape, or form, or in the hunting community some way, shape, or form, about ways that we can help promote hunting to new hunters. And you gave a little presentation there, and that's this connection. That's why I reached out to you and said, hey, why don't you come on the podcast and tell your story? So I think...
Oh, thank you.
So I think what I want to do is I want to start all the way at the very beginning. And the first question, knowing that you necessarily weren't a hunter, when was your first experience? I mean, did you come from an outdoor family at all? Did you know anybody that was a hunter growing up? What was your life like before you became curious about hunting?
So weirdly enough, I grew up in like kind of on the outskirts of Columbus, Ohio. So like pretty like rural community. I've been, my family is definitely not an outdoorsy family, but I've always been the outdoorsy person in my family. And I played sports and rode horses and, you know, did that. And a lot of my friends out there were deer hunters. So kind of interestingly enough, like my best guy friend hunted whitetails with his family every year, and he just wanted me to be able to come to hunting camp. So I was actually in the process of signing up for my hunter's education when we ended up moving halfway through my junior year of high school to Colorado. So it was less about hunting and more about like going and hanging out with my best friend's family. But I didn't have like a bad, like I ate venison at friends' houses growing up. You know, Ohio has a really cool whitetail community, and hunting community. And so I was adjacent to it, and I certainly wasn't against it, you know? But then we moved to Colorado and so that was sort of not, on the table anymore. So I don't think that I really thought about hunting again until my 20s, when my mom ended up marrying someone who was a hunter. And so like I always had wild game in my freezer, and like got to hear these great stories about going on these mountain trips to, you know, hunt elk. And my stepbrothers were really big into hunting, so it was fun to talk to them. And then kind of around the age of like 26, and I said this on the ATA panel, I read an essay by Tom McGuane, which was, it's called Heart of the Game, and it was in the initial Outside magazine, like the very first issue that they published. It was the feature article in there. So I think that was 1978 that the article came out, and I randomly picked up this book and have always been a voracious reader. And McGuane's experience hunting in Montana and the way that he explained it, like really gave me an empathetic view for hunting and what hunting could be, and kind of like set the scenario, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That like when, in 2014, I found a position online for a show called Meat Eater, which like I had no understanding of it or like who Steve Rinella was at that point, but they had a Craigslist ad for a social media community manager, and I'm not sure that I would have considered working for a hunting show like had I not had those previous experiences, you know.
Yeah.
And I actually did a lot of research before I took the job because I didn't want to get into a position where I felt like that integrity wasn't a value within that particular media outlet. And yeah, that kind of changed a lot for me.
Okay. There. So it sounds like to me like you were just getting ready to get your feet wet with hunting before a move forced you to go to Colorado. Were there any opportunities in Colorado or in your early 20s or in your 20s or, you know, however old you are now, between the time you went to Colorado and you went to Montana, where you could have gotten your feet wet again?
I had friends in college that were waterfowl hunters. But a few of them had GSPs that were just not very well trained and not fun to be around because they were college dogs. And so like, it wasn't really something that like, I didn't understand it. And it was, something that we all kind of like teased each other about more than anything. So it's sort of funny that I really love waterfowl hunting now. But no, you know, I didn't have a ton of exposure to it in Colorado. And at that point, I didn't really have any interest in it. I mean, I'll be totally clear. The only reason I was going to get my hunting license was so that I could go to my friend's hunting camp and hang out with his family. It wasn't like I didn't shoot a gun until I was 30 years old.
Okay.
So I grew up around guns and I grew up like respecting guns, but that wasn't really like a crux of interest for me.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So you, as a non-hunter at that point in your life, your outlook at hunting wasn't necessarily so bad because you had, I guess you had a foot in the door, so to speak, or you had insight through your friends who were hunters, right? Do you think that that made it easier for you to eventually take that jump into becoming a hunter?
Not really. I think so. I'll take a step back. So when I moved to Montana in 2012, I wasn't really an outdoors person. Like I said, I've ridden horses my whole life. Like, I'm still an equestrian. I hiked a little bit in Colorado, but when I got to Montana, I really got into the outdoors, started hiking. In 2014, I backpacked 150 miles on the Continental Divide Trail by myself. And that was kind of like a post, I left corporate America, which I'd been working in for like 5 years at that point. And I really wanted to change not only my life, but like my profession and my career. And there's something about Montana where like the landscape is just really accessible. Like, hiking is everywhere. I'm looking out my window right now at public land. Like, it's just all around you, you know. It's hard to avoid almost.
Yeah.
Like, this idea of like constant recreation, where like when I was living in Denver, you know, I lived in downtown Denver. I actually did stand-up comedy. That was my hobby then. And yeah. And so like, I was like the furthest thing you could be from like an outdoors person, you know. Like, I didn't know a spike bull from a cow, you know. Like, so the education was swift and fierce when it came. And like, the reality is that when I was backpacking by myself, I was having a lot of these really intense experiences with wildlife. This was before I had a dog. So I was like literally just out on the trail, like in grizzly country by myself, like hiking like 14, 15 miles a day, you know. And I had like a really incredible experience where I was eating dinner at the top of this valley and like kind of had tucked my tent up against the lodgepole pine. And I had over 100 elk walk out in front of me while I was eating dinner, like right as the sun was going down. And those elk grazed around my tent all night, like mewing and talking and playing. And there were like coyotes like yodeling in the distance, and like perfect starry like summer night. It was just like, it's one of those nights that like just stay with you forever, you know? And after that, I like was, you know, spent a lot of time walking, and I'm like, who gets to do this? Like, who gets to have these really intimate connections with animals and like understand where they are and what are they doing? I mean, I just walked through that forest and there was this, a herd of 100 elk, you know, probably like within a couple hundred yards, and I had no idea they were there, you know?
Yeah.
And so my curiosity was really piqued by that. And really, like, serendipitously, it was just a couple months later that I ended up getting the meat eater job. So, I mean, one thing that I tell people is my learning curve is very different than, like, most new hunters, because I ended up working in the industry, you know. And, like, would I have had an outlet to learn how to hunt had I, you know, not taken that path? Or, like, would I would have followed that intuition about hunting? Like, I'm not sure, you know. I can't go back and relive that part of my life and like know how it would have turned out. So
yeah.
Like, but 6 years later, I am a hunter.
Okay.
And I'm still in the industry. So
So let me ask you this: what came first? You picking up that book and reading it, or your job with Meat Eater?
Oh, the book.
That the was book. Like more okay. than 10. Okay.
So the book is I have it on my shelf right now. It's the best of outside 25 years. So like, the book isn't about hunting at all. It's about the feature essays that, you know, like Annie Prue wrote and Ed Abbey wrote for Outside Magazine. And the lead feature of that book is Tom McGuane's essay about hunting. But the rest of the story isn't about hunting. The rest of that book isn't about hunting at all.
So okay.
I wasn't picking up a book about hunting and expecting to read about, you know, how hunting can be a serious and like really spiritual pursuit. But that was just the first essay like in that collection, and it's just stuck with me. It always has. He's become one of my favorite writers.
Okay, so how long until you pick that book up and you become inspired by these words until you started to take the steps to become a hunter?
Well, I will say that the essay didn't inspire me to become a hunter. So I like want to make that clear.
Okay.
Like what it showed me was that a hunter could have empathy for animals.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So like, I realized that there could be a different kind of hunter than a lot of the hunters that I had been around, which talked about, you know, Boone and Crockett records and stuff like that. Like, that was more of like the attitude that I was exposed to, like less about the meat. Like, it was awesome for me to have elk and bison and all that stuff in my freezer, but you know, that essay changed what a hunter could be in my mind, and it didn't make me want to hunt. Like, honestly, like, I didn't want to own a gun. I didn't want to shoot a gun. You know, like, I was definitely a person who was like, if you would have told me even after reading that essay that I would be sitting in a house with guns right now, I would tell you that you were crazy or that I was gonna hunt. You know, like,
yeah.
I had no interest in killing an animal. You know, I've been around big animals my whole life. And I've seen how they die, and it can be really hard, right? Like, you know, I've had favorite horses die and been around there for accidents and all that kind of stuff. So like at that point, like, I just wasn't ready to like emotionally even think about it, you know, but I really think it was that backpacking trip where I had all this downtime and all this time to just move across the landscape and understand wildlife and understand what it means to be in the mountains and to spend that kind of time there. You know, I felt like a really intense, I don't know, connection to the ecosystem.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that was what made me curious to be a hunter.
Yeah.
I think like all that previous knowledge was helpful. It's like, okay, like I don't have to be hunting something for the size of its antlers. Like I can hunt something because I'm curious about its behavior and I'm curious about its, you know, like about putting food in my freezer. You know, that was really the lesson that I took from Meat Eater was, you know, this sea change from talking about hunting in a way that people can understand from the food perspective, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that all those little things were additive to allowing me to be curious about it.
Okay.
Rather than me being like, okay, well, now I want to hunt. You know, like, that didn't happen until it happened inside of me.
Yeah.
I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
That sounds really frou-frou.
Yeah.
Hey, it's so true.
I'll tell you what, man. I didn't grow up in a hunting family. I became interested in hunting kind of on my own through, I guess my uncles did some hunting, but I live so far away from them that, you know, I didn't really have necessarily a mentor, so to speak. So I had to do a lot of learning on my own. Then I hit high school. I didn't hardly hunt at all, went to college, hunted even less. And then, just like you said, I picked up my bow, my old bow, went out to the woods one day, and and just had this, I didn't even see a deer. I just had this perfect scenario play out in front of me where it was like the most beautiful October sunset in the, you know, the leaves are all bright colors. It's like a yellow hue in the sky, just like, and then the noise and this, the air and the smells and the taste and the visual that all played like this, this connection, like you said, to the ecosystem is, yeah, is what hooked me to getting back out. And I said to myself, man, I got to spend as much time doing this as I possibly can. And that was kind of a re-triggering of my passion for the outdoors. Now, the next question I have for you, so all these things have kind of started to get your curiosity to boil. Was it you yourself who started taking the steps, or did you have a little help from somebody else kind of pushing you into becoming a hunter?
So, like, my best girlfriend in Bozeman, she grew up in a hunting family, and she grew up hunting, and she invited me to go shooting with her. And so, like, we went out with her and her now husband and a bunch of friends, and, like, I got to shoot her grandma's 308. And her grandma's a pretty incredible woman. Like, she hunted elk by herself in the Scapegoat Wilderness and the Bob Marshall Wilderness for 50 years. And so there was this, like, also really strong story of, like, kind of a matriarchal hunting family, I guess, like, in Lindsay's history and tradition. And so, like, they sort of made the firearms thing, like, open to me and, like, got to go out and shoot. And I had a lot of fun doing that. And then, I mean, working for Meat Eater, I mean, you know, so in December of 2014, I start working for Meat Eater, and I'm sitting 6 feet away from Giannis Patelis, who, like, in my mind is, like, one of the most knowledgeable people, like, that I've ever met in the hunting world, and has, like, a very, like, kind and connected way of talking about it. And I was basically, you know, I was managing their social media community, so I'm consistently fielding questions. I was a total non-hunter at that point, so, like, I didn't know how to respond. So I, like, was basically asking 100 questions a day, like, and really absorbing it and learning it and figuring it all out. And then, so fall of 2015 was my first hunting season, and I did, like, all the hunter's ed and really practiced shooting, got my first gun. Giannis would take me out shooting. Like, we'd meet at the range before work. So, you know, I had people that were willing to help me out, you know?
Yeah.
But it was, like, on my own volition, you know, like, yeah, there was nobody, like, there, like Giannis would be like, I'm going shooting at 7 o'clock in the morning. Does anyone want to go? And we'd, like, meet him out there, you know? So, like, I mean, you can't really ask for a better position to be in as a new hunter, like, you know, between, like, Giannis and Steve and everyone else that worked there. I mean, there were a lot of us that were new hunters. If you go back to, I think it's in the first 30 Meat Eater episodes, there's a podcast of the three of us, like, three girls that worked there talking about our first season's hunting. So there was certainly a lot of space to learn, and it was, like, I don't know. I don't want to, like, beat a dead horse. It was a great place to learn.
Yeah.
And I had, like, people that would take me, and Giannis took me on my first deer hunt, you know, and it was another hunt just before work. We got up at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning. Like, we were in the office by 8, and we had a deer kind of pop up on us at, like, 20 yards. And when I went to put up my gun, I couldn't find her in the scope, but my scope was turned, like, to 12x, you know, like, it was completely, like, on the high end of magnification, so I couldn't find her in my scope. And Giannis just turned on the magnification, and he was like, all right, there's a lesson, you know, like, and that's really just how I've taken it. There's always something to learn.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And I've been able to pack my last two bucks out of the backcountry and public land by myself, so I think the learning curve is faster than we give it credit for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What kind of conversations did you have in your head at the time where, you know, and I think this is where a lot of people, you know, we always talk about this disconnect between where our food comes from, right? We can go to McDonald's, somebody will hand us a hamburger through the drive-thru and we eat it without even thinking about where that meat came from, right? So yeah. The general public, I would say, has a big disconnect about where meat specifically comes from and how many people touch it. And that an animal actually has to die in order for you to enjoy that hamburger or steak or chicken sandwich or whatever. What kind of conversations did you have with yourself about this realization that if I'm going to become a hunter, I have to kill something?
It was something I didn't know that I was going to be able to do. You know what I mean? I love animals. Like, animals are part of my daily life. I mean, you know, I went out and fed my horse this morning, and my animals are always all around me, and you know, I love seeing wildlife. Like, I get so excited to see a bear. Like, I still get really excited about those things. Like, there's a real like childlike sense of awe and wonder for me around wildlife, and luckily, like, I'm on a landscape, I get to see them every day. You know, like, all winter, there's a herd of 40 elk that live out with my horse. So, like, it's very constant in this world that I'm in. I knew that it was going to take me looking through the scope, having an animal on the other end, and seeing if I could pull the trigger. And I knew I had to get to that point, you know? Like, I wasn't going to second-guess myself because I didn't know who I was going to be in that situation. But when it came down to it, I could, you know?
Yeah.
And I could live with the consequences of it.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, the emotional weight of hunting is something that, like, especially adults, like men and women, you know, like, people of any race or ethnicity are going to take into account if that's not something that they've done before. Like, killing is not, you know, unless you're a part of our military, like shooting guns and killing doesn't really exist on our landscape other than within hunting, you know?
Yeah.
Or like industrial meat or like, you know, these other worlds that are very shut off to us. I mean, we live in a society that has a very high value on life.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. And a lot of anxiety around death.
Yeah.
So
that's a fact.
We have to we have to take that into account when we talk about it. We have to take that into account when we're listening to why people are upset about hunting. Like, they have valid reasons. And I think we need to have empathy for that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I feel it's weird. You know, I come from a farming families, right? And there was livestock on the farm, and you know, we didn't necessarily take everything to, like, I won't say my mom and dad were farmers, but I grew up on a farm. Like, my grandparents were my babysitters. So I watched death all the time, whether it was, you know, typical farming where, you know, it's time to kill a pig and eat it. It's time to kill a cow and eat it, or a chicken and eat it. So I feel like in a way I was desensitized at an early age about death, because I knew where everything came from. And I can remember feeling sorry maybe the first time I witnessed it, but then after that it was just, this is how life is, this is how it goes. So when you did pull that gun up for the first time, what was going through your head? I mean, were you thinking about that animal's life, or were you more concentrated on, like, was most of your concentration on pulling the trigger for a quick ethical kill?
Well, the first time I shot at an animal, I missed it completely. So, I think, like, that moment was more about the curiosity, am I going to pull the trigger?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, it's so overwhelming to be in that position. And then, like, the first deer that I ended up killing was a very weird situation. And I took a bad shot initially out of that adrenaline. And part of that adrenaline is wanting to take the best shot that you can. But at the end of the day, you're also a beginner, right? And so, like, that sense of, okay, like, I have this opportunity and I'm going to take it, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a perfect opportunity. Do you know what? Like,
yeah,
it is very hard to be a beginner and be good at something.
Yeah.
Like, it's very hard, you know, like the last two shots that I've taken on deer have both been great shots. Like, but it took going through it a couple times, like, to understand it, you know. I don't know how to put words to that other than just you get better with time.
Yeah.
Just being able to calm yourself down.
But what about the emotions? You know, what about the emotions towards the animal? Because you mentioned that you love animals, right? And
yeah,
you end up killing this animal. Did you have a sense of, like, remorse? Did you have second thoughts about, hey man, is this really for me? Or did you have this deep connection right off the bat?
I mean, I still have thoughts, is this really for me? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if you're hunting and you're really, like, considering what's on the other end of your rifle, like, that should be a question that we're always thinking about. Like, you know, how committed am I to, like, the life on the other end of this, you know, boomstick? Like, it has value. Like,
yeah.
I think, I just think, so I'll explain it in my past two books. So my 2017, and I didn't kill anything last year. I've been going through, like, some pretty serious, like, knee problems, and I've had a bunch of surgeries. So last year was kind of a wash for me. So my 2017 buck that I killed him after hunting for 9 days by myself in Montana. I was doing day trips and hunting out of camps, and I really, really hunted hard, and I put a lot of miles on the ground, and I had a couple opportunities, but, like, they didn't feel perfect, and so I wasn't going to risk putting an animal in a position that I didn't want to put it in. So on that last day, I'm on a high ridge in an area called the Lee Metcalf Wilderness. And I had actually, it was like 50 mile per hour winds. It was really cold by myself. And I'd hiked like 6 miles. And so I just decided to go back to the car. I'd actually unloaded my gun and put it in my pack and was just going to hike down and came over this hill. And there were 14 mule deer just right in front of me. And so I ended up, there were two bucks in the herd, and this is an area where you can't kill does. So there was a bigger buck, like a bigger, nicer buck. And then there was a porky that was like good sized body, but like obviously a younger buck. But he gave me like a perfect broadside shot at like 72 yards. And I took it, and he was dead so quickly that like I didn't cry. Like I teared up. And I was just so grateful that, like, the death was swift and that there was minimal suffering. And I had a lot of work to do, you know, to get that deer off the mountain. So in that scenario, I really, like, the majority of the emotion that I felt was just being grateful, you know. But my next deer that I killed in 2018, and that one happened really fast, right? Like, I only had, like, I had like 2 minutes to make a decision. Like, I'm going to get my gun out. I'm going to load my gun. And I'm, you know, going to kill this deer. And I did. So like the next year, I didn't have as much time to hunt, you know, so I didn't really get to spend as much time on the landscape. The season was ending that weekend. I'd been at like a ton of trade shows and just like my hunting season was just felt like a wash. I was pretty frustrated with the fact that, like, I hadn't been able to hunt very much and be outside, like, in that place that I really loved. And I made myself a promise that the first animal that I had an ethical shot on, I was going to take it no matter what. And so, like, I camped out, ended up finding a pretty nice buck. He was about a mile and a half away in sagebrush. I was in eastern Montana, you know, so I figured I was going to blow him. And I ended up walking, like, in on him to 90 yards. So I, you know, over the course of, like, an hour and a half or 2 hours, I walked him super slowly, ended up getting a shot at 97 yards. But I had kind of, like, grown attached to him at that point because I'd been watching him for so long, you know? And I cried from, like, the deep well of my soul when I killed that deer. Like, I was just, like, beside myself. And I almost felt, like, disgusted with myself when I walked up to him. And, like, it took a little while for that to wear off. And I think part of that was just, like, I hadn't done enough hunting. I didn't feel like I had really earned it. You know, like, there were a lot of, like, things at that point. And the thing was, it was a perfect, perfect shot. Like, double lung, like, just immediately downed him, like, you know, dead within a minute. Like, nice buck. That kill was just hard for me, but I think it was a reflection of a lot of other things that were going on. You know, like, I don't think that it was a reflection on that particular, you know, I don't think it was a reflection on hunting or killing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's hard to put into words.
Yeah.
You know? And then I got a chance to, like, go waterfowl hunting, and I had so much fun. You know, like, I went out and I, like, went goose hunting and duck hunting and went on some really great trips with some really great people for work. And I was like, wow, like, this can be fun.
Yeah.
You know, like, for me, big game hunting is not necessarily fun. You know, like, killing a big game animal to me is a big responsibility. So then I was like, I sort of got into, like, an ethical questioning with myself, like, because I think a lot about, like, the hierarchy of animals. And I think that, like, in hunting, there should be, like, an equality, right? Like, we hunt deer for wildlife management. We hunt black bears for wildlife management. You know, like, there's the big argument about grizzly bears. Like, I'm for hunting grizzly bears for the purpose of wildlife management. And, like, for, you know, understanding that there shouldn't be a hierarchy across species, you know, that it should come down to science and management.
Yeah.
So when I actually was having fun, like, killing geese and ducks, it was like, okay, like, how is this different from killing a deer for me?
Yeah.
You know, it just weighed on me a lot differently. And that was an interesting experience. So I don't know. I'm like, I'm clearly very heady.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, my wife, I don't think she will ever feel comfortable shooting a deer. She may come out and try, but I feel like there's something that will happen in the last moment where she may not go through with it. Hell, she might. That's on her. But it's easy for her to kill a turkey. I mean, she's killed five turkeys. When I asked her about it, I said, hey, you know, why is it so easy for you to shoot a turkey and it's so difficult for you to shoot a deer? And she said, just the way they look, straight up. Like, turkeys are ugly, and they're a bird and an animal. Like, the deer is, like, majestic, and it has these big eyes, and it's beautiful, and, you know, it owns the woods, and it approaches different, and it leaves different, you know, like, so do you think that there's that, you know, knowing that if we're going to get more non-hunters into hunting, is there a different path than coming straight to deer hunting or big game?
You know, a lot of my girlfriends said they'd be fine going bird hunting, but they never want to kill big game. And I think that that's a really interesting, I think that once you have, it's hard because I did it backwards, right? Like, I went immediately into deer hunting. But I was also thinking about the meat, right?
Right.
So, like, I'm not saying that you can't get a lot of meat from birds. You certainly can if you have a great day. But, like, it's never going to be, you know, packing 80 pounds of meat out on your back. Like, you know, I don't know. I mean, here's my thing about recruiting people. I, like, you and I both had similar experiences where we had a really intrinsic moment in the outdoors where we were like, oh, right, like, I need to do this, you know, like, this is clearly a part of who I am. And that's like something that I need to go explore, right? Like, want to go explore the woods and like have these experiences with wildlife. Like, I think if you want to expose people to the idea of hunting, like, they first have to have those experiences outside that are like spiritual but benign, I guess. Like, I don't think that, like, I don't think you're ever going to recruit someone to hunting that doesn't have a baseline understanding about what happens in outdoor spaces.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
And killing something is like really personal. So like, people really have to like do, most people have to do like some level of an emotional work to understand that, you know, like even guns are something for people to get over, you know, like, I'll say that once I started shooting a bow, I became a lot more excited about hunting, you know, like, I love shoot. I would much rather go shoot my bow all day than go to the range and shoot my rifle. Like, one, it doesn't like kick, you know, it's a totally different experience. And like, I don't know, like, I've had that like conversation with a lot of women and they feel the same way. Like, guns just hold like a different space in our public imagination. You know, there's so much like political controversy around them that like people don't understand them as a tool.
Yeah.
And that was something that I had to get over before I decided to hunt.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, especially for the people in maybe bigger cities or more of an urban area. That they may have grown up with a negative connotation about guns their whole life. Like, the only time that they saw a gun was either by a police officer or by a criminal. Right. So, yeah. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, when we talk about, you know, this, the recruitment, do you feel, and we talk about the media within the hunting industry, right? You were not a hunter. You came into the hunting industry and then became a hunter. What are your thoughts on the hunting industry and how good or bad of a job that they are currently doing in what we're putting out there as far as media to new hunters? And what I mean by that is my introduction into hunting media was, first off, it was magazines like Outdoor Life and Field and Stream. You get it, and then you become curious, so then you start buying the videos. And the videos that I would always buy were the whack 'em, stack 'em, 5 minutes in a tree stand, big buck comes through, shoot 'em, you know, big bucks, or, you know, like real trees, monster bucks or whatever. And it's just a whack 'em, stack 'em mentality. And working for Meat Eater, it is a little bit different because they go into a little bit more detail about the process of the kill and hunting and focus on the food. Where does the hunting industry as a whole stand, do you think?
Yeah. So I would say that this has been, and to be clear, I've been working in the media industry for 6 years now. So like my position on this has evolved so much, right? Like, coming in as a non-hunter, there were a lot of things that I was like horrified at, and then eventually was able to really understand context, right? And I think we talk about that a lot on that ATA panel, about the idea of context within what we put out there. But I also think that there's a space for hunters to have their insular moments, right? Like, I understand like that there are a lot of people who are more of that like whack 'em and stack 'em mentality, and like, I don't necessarily like, I personally am not going to consume that kind of media, but like, I understand that there's an audience for it. Does it hurt our, like, hunting as a whole? I think sometimes it does. I think that, you know, when the wrong thing goes viral, like, it has consequences for the hunting community on a whole, right? Like, but I also think that if people are conscientious consumers, then there's hunting media out there right now that didn't maybe exist 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, I think that the good thing about what social media has done for hunting is that it's democratized it. You know, like, you have a lot more people that are food focused, like Renella or Hank Shaw, you know, like Danielle Pruitt, it, like, does a lot of amazing food stuff, like, for Meat Eater. And there are people that are, like, bringing hunting into the conversation, you know, like Anthony Bourdain went hunting in Montana for one of his shows a couple of years ago. And, you know, like, Meat Eater is actually a part of that production company. That's the production company that I worked for. So I think that, like, when hunting media comes from a collaboration between hunters and non-hunters, we see things that are really different, you know, and I think that's where Meat Eater started. I've taken some public issue with Meat Eater's issues with representation at the moment. But that doesn't mean that I don't still stand by a lot of the media that they've put out over the long term, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there are places, I think social media does democratize hunting media a lot. And I think that anyone can find the community that they belong to within that sphere. You know, for me, it was the Meat Eater crew. It was Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, where I also worked, like, Artemis Sportswomen, and really just the sort of community around conservation gave me a place to be that wasn't, you know, that sort of very testosterone fueled world of hunting.
Yeah.
You know,
let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Because every once in a while, you'll, you know, especially during the hunting season, you'll scroll through Instagram and you'll see a picture of, and I've been guilty of this in the past, or, you know, I've shared content like this where I will show a picture of the heart or a picture of the lung where the broadhead has gone through. Right. And for a non-hunter, someone may look at that and go, oh my God, I can't believe that they posted that picture. And me, a seasoned hunter, and all my other seasoned hunter friends will look at that and go, great shot. You know what I mean?
Great shot.
Great shot.
Yeah.
Has your view on imagery that may be gruesome or grotesque 6 or 7 years ago changed?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I killed my first deer, the first picture that I put out was actually a cleaned heart, intact, with thyme and garlic by it on, like, a wood cutting board. So, like, it was a very different kind of heart picture.
Yeah.
You know, like, that was the first thing that I ate from my deer. And, like, the response that I got was amazing from, like, from my non-hunter friends who are, like, you know, a lot of my non-hunter friends are, like, what is going on with you? Like, why are you hunting? You know? But, like, it's also opened them all up to the idea of hunting as, like, as a pursuit of integrity.
Yeah.
You know, like, that it can be, like, heartfelt, and that it can be a whole human experience that, like, respects the animal holistically. And I'm not saying that I do things perfectly. I certainly don't. But, like, as a communicator, I'm very, very aware that the majority of my, like, followers on Instagram, that the majority of my friends on Facebook, that, like, the majority of my social circle is still people that don't hunt.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, I have a deep empathy for where they are at with their education on what hunting is. But I also know a lot of people that grew up in traditional hunting communities that, like, they were only surrounded by hunters. So, like, they didn't really have to worry about that context.
Yeah.
I, I mean, I think that showing meat and showing an animal and showing like a heart shot is important. You know, I think it's important for people to understand that this is a life. I think it's important for them to know that like people are showing that because it was like a very ethical, quick death for that animal, you know? But like, we're the ones who are responsible to put that language around it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. I can't do that for you, you know? And still at the end of the day, you're also going to have a lot of people that don't want to have that empathy or don't want to have that sort of, they don't want to be a teacher. Like, right. Like, and that's also fine. Like, it shouldn't be on every hunter to be an ambassador for the sport. I think the unfortunate nature of the world that we live in is that if your Instagram is public and like you have a lot of Facebook friends from different backgrounds, then like you are by default an educator.
Yeah. Whether, you know? Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, this has been a very interesting conversation, Nicole, and I really want to thank you for taking time out of your day to come on and share your road to becoming a hunter. Is this something that just continues to grow for you? I mean, are you in it deep now?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I was checking. I've been like waiting for the pronghorn tags to come out. You know, I think I just have a pile of tags this year, and after going through a couple of knee surgeries and starting to feel healthy again, like there's nothing that like gets me more excited than fall. You know, like last September I got within 40 yards of a cow elk on a solo archery hunt. You know, like stuff like that is like food for my soul.
Yeah.
And like at the end of the day, like I'd certainly love to have the meat in the freezer, but the experience is just as important, and it's that thing that I've been working towards. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in a way, like, hunting is kind of a small percentage of my life on a day-to-day basis, but it's also part of my profession, and I'm really excited to be able to communicate that to people. Like, to me, it's, you know, like we all come from hunters. We wouldn't be here without like the connection that we have to wildlife and, like I said, the ecosystem. And I think that's a story that is still worth being told. And I hope that like when people realize that they're telling that story, like they will take into account that like there are hearts and minds that will change when we tell those stories well. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Nicole, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Dana, it's such a pleasure.
And there you have it. Another episode in the books. Huge shout out to Nicole. Huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to listen to this episode. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And a huge shout out to the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast for helping make this happen. Vortex Optics, The Average Conservationist, Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands, Wasp Broadheads, and last but not least, Ozonic Scent Elimination Units, man. Please go out, support the companies that support this podcast. Make sure you're following the Nine Finger Chronicles on Instagram and social, which is Instagram. So Facebook, Instagram, we are on Go Wild as well. That's a nice app that you guys need to go check out. Other than that, I think we're good. Hopefully everybody has a great day, man. Send good vibes out to the universe, and I swear to God, you'll get them back, man. I love every one of you. Have a good rest of your evening, day, month, week, year, and we'll talk to you next time. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.